Welcome to another episode of Rhythm and Brews. Our theme today is Desert Island. That is, if you were stranded on a desert island and you had a lifetime supply of any one beer or could take one album with you, what would those be? Here to talk about his desert island picks is one of my good friends and one of my oldest musical collaborators,
Mr. Mike Kennedy.
That's me.
We played in one band together?
It in various iterations, you know, who knows what, everything moves so fast. You got one practice one day where it was a ska band or something. And
sure.
And then like maybe 6 months later, a couple more people or a little influence from here or there. And it was, we played for a while.
That's a good point. We had a bunch of different little iterations.
There was a time though, where one of our friends sort of put a recording studio together in their home. And we put a couple tracks together and made some recordings, and that sort of felt like it was a thing, or like at that point you had to call it a band at that point. So that's what it was.
We had some notoriety at our high school.
I wouldn't even call it that.
Yeah,
people knew who we were.
I just did, yep. But yeah. Well, it was. I just mean we went to a pretty small high school, and there were two bands that people probably knew about from that high school, and we were probably the second most well known.
Sure.
Right, alongside Unleaded Pedestrians. That was one of the more legit musical projects I had, just in terms of like playing shows, and we had a decent EP that was pretty decent.
And the Unleaded Pedestrians, you know, they won that giant battle of the bands I'll never forget out at the Worcester Palladium. And I remember our buddy, we all jumped in a car afterwards and I don't know, drove to celebrate somewhere. I don't know. It was a great night.
I think you are thinking of our friend Raffy's band.
Oh, I'm thinking, yeah.
The Upper Hand.
The Upper Hand. Yeah, sorry.
With also had Anthony Rainville of the now band Stay. I think they're still doing stuff, but I don't know.
Go back and re-record all that. No, I'm just saying. Yeah, you're right. Okay, I remember the other band you're talking about now.
Unleaded Pedestrians were our friends, our classmates, Paul Gordon and Mike Tischel,
mm-hmm.
Probably names you haven't heard in a long time.
Yeah, but I remember them.
Yeah, I had we
all nice guys.
Yeah, all very nice guys. We had I had my 10-year high school reunion a couple of years back, and all of those guys were there, and they played all their greatest hits. They did a little acoustic show for us. Yeah,
I skipped mine.
That was a throwback. Well. You're probably right to have done that. It was very weird. It was in the cafeteria of the high school. We had like tomato soup and grilled cheese. There was no booze, which is like a
long
disaster.
Short, folks. We go way back here. We're talking about cafeterias in high school.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of which, so after you graciously agreed to come on the show and we decided that we're going to have our theme be Desert Island. I don't know if you'll remember this, but I remember years and years and years ago, this probably was in high school, you saying to me that you had this like long-term dream of retiring, moving to Fiji, and opening a crepe shop. Does that ring any bell at all for you?
Yeah, that would have been a different me at the time, probably. I remember. Yeah, I think I remember sort of maybe learning about crepes and being fascinated within the term of like a season. So, you know, it's easy to impress a kid. I think a crepe was like one of those like magical things. I knew pancakes, and then crepes came out. And Fiji, who knows? You know, it's a stand-in for like any exotic location at the time. But you know,
it's
I never
weird to see you like psychoanalyze yourself from 10 years ago.
I'm a pretty metacognitive guy. Like I got to think back. I'm all in my head all the time. So, and the dream hasn't changed that much. I still kind of think of retiring somewhere really placid and you know, you gave me a couple options you showed me the themes that were coming up and I kind of knew the one I wanted to pick.
Well, and it's just, it's funny to me because I can envision you on that island flipping crepes.
Or whatever. I think I'm somebody who can keep myself occupied even when I'm by myself and a good population of oysters, I could survive. Something like that.
Sure.
You know, it wouldn't be so bad. And I think The choices I made here are sort of like root right in decisions. Like what if I had to just like really cope with a situation that, the classic desert island conundrum is like, it's not your will to be there. Like you're stranded by virtue of being on the island. So it's gotta be, it's a coping mechanism question. So,
well, and so we specifically, I mean, for the most part, I wanted to have you on to talk about your Desert Island album, the one album you listened to for however long you're trapped on this island. But before we get into that, we always start the show with the segment we call BYOB. So do you want to talk to me about what you brought today and
well,
how it ties
sure.
into the theme for you?
I think our listeners should know that it's early in the afternoon. So I picked a beer that, you know, goes well with any occasion. And sort of, you know, both of my choices are really kind of bottom barrel. Like, who would pick that kind of choice? But I brought Miller High Life. You know, my friends will tell you it's usually in my fridge and I keep it around, for a lot of reasons. It's a banquet beer, you know, it's a pretty simple beer. It's basically, you know, it's not really a heavy hitter either. So,
but
there's a couple things I like about it.
It has longevity. Like I that's one of the few beers I can think back to drinking regularly in my college years and still enjoying for the most part. Otherwise it was like Coors Light and things in that family. And not that I am too snobby now to slum it with a Coors Light, but if you're giving me the choice between a Coors Light and a Miller High Life, hands down, I'm going Miller High Life.
Yeah. You know, I've never been a light beer drinker. High Life's about as light as I go. And I think the banquet threshold is sort of the, like, you got your Budweiser heavy, and I could always enjoy one.
Sure.
You know, even Coors has their banquet offering, but I don't drink anything with light in the name, and I never really have. But
yeah, well, and I think the other thing too is it's well balanced, so it's not. I feel like so many beers that I get into, I'm into them for a short burst, and then I'm like, I'm so sick of this because it's so specific. It's like, I can't just taste hops anymore, or I can't just taste sour anymore. Like, it's too much of the same
yep.
flavor. It's like when you get truffle oil in some food that you're getting, and you're like, how many bites of the same exact pronounced flavor can I have over and over again?
Well, and so the desert island concept, I honestly think about temperature and the temperature of the beer on that desert island as a key factor. So
yeah.
A Miller High Life's a beer. You don't really want to drink it warm. Because the flavor opens up way too much, and someone will disagree with me out there. But even ice cold, you know, there's not a lot of flavor profile. So if it's too cold, you don't get a lot out of it
sure.
in terms of flavor. But, you know, if you had a big case of them and you just stuck them out there in the ocean, I have to imagine like 45 to 65 degrees any day of the year, you'd pull one out and probably still enjoy it.
So I'll tell you what I brought. There's a couple of things that would matter to me in this scenario. I'd want something that I think could reliably get me drunk, because that would be, I think, at least for a few weeks until it's kind of your new normal, I would be panicking and feel a lot of fear and angst. And so to have something that can kind of take the edge off and help me cope a little bit would be nice. Equally, though, I wouldn't want something that is only for that purpose. Once I've kind of mellowed out and I'm like, I guess this is just my life now for the next 4 to 30 years or whatever the case may be, is this something I'll still enjoy? And any listeners of the show know that I am a huge Belgian beer guy. That's like my favorite genre of beer, if you will. And this beer that I brought today is Le Chouf. It's a Belgian strong pale ale. So it's got a kick from an ABV standpoint, but it's like one of the most drinkable beers I've ever had in my life. It's one of my all-time favorites, hands down. So anyway, that's what I'd go with. I actually just had this on draft for the first time. I was in New York City with my wife the past couple of days, and there's this little bar, I guess it's mainly a bar. They have like Belgian frites and stuff, but it's a ton of Belgian beers on draft, and it was like dream come true for me.
But normally you wouldn't find this on tap, but you could find it at like a craft beer store.
It's snobby in that sense. It's like you probably aren't gonna find it at your local liquor store. You gotta go to a place that has craft in their name.
Well, it's imported.
It's a fancy schmancy import, but
yeah, crack it open.
If you can find it, if you have any sort of love for Belgian beers, I'd highly recommend it. All right, let's do it. Cheers. Well, before I have you introduce your pick, I wanted to ask what for you makes for a great desert island pick? Like, what boxes does an album have to check for you to consider it as a possible desert island pick?
Yeah, I think it's really repeatability. So it has to be sort of, the appreciation of the album has to be there, but it also has to be palatable. It can't really be, you know, like I have some favorite albums that I wouldn't call a desert island pick just because you wouldn't want to listen to it back to back more than like two times. And there's a reason they use music as a torture device. You know, it's you don't want to oversaturate yourself with stimulation in a certain way. So anyway, so that's part of it. It's sort of got to be tolerable, yep. And kind of even keeled. I think about somebody in the desert island context, sort of, you know, in survival mode. So it sort of has to help you as a coping mechanism for that. Sort of keep your mind in a good space to maybe keep working ahead at your Swiss Family Robinson treehouse or something like that. So I kind of picture some sort of album that's going to keep time, really. I'm thinking about, like, how am I going to tap my toe and strut around the island and figure it out and keep my head in a good place. So, so I'm looking for an album that, you can listen to a bunch of times over and over and over again, you know, back to front to front to back. And that, you know, sort of has that sort of walking, beat per minute kind of tempo. Like, it's gotta be high energy enough that you don't just like sit around all day, that you kind of plug away. So
that's what I was thinking. Yeah. It's something that wouldn't allow you to despair.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
Not that despair is something that shouldn't be dwelt upon. I think, you kind of want to acknowledge that you're stuck on a desert island, and at the same time, you kind of want to cope with it and deal with it and make the best of it. And you know, ideally, like maybe you decide to stick around. You know, I have to imagine the Swiss Family Robinsons themselves at the end of the film, like, might have decided on their Papua New Guinea hideaway.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
They set it up pretty nice. I mean, we all go to Disneyland to walk through a recreation because we idealize it. Something about a treehouse or something about...
Well, there's something about just escaping. And I say this to Katrina all the time. Like, do you ever just fantasize about something terrible happening just to shake things up? Like, because it's so easy to get sucked into that, like, Pleasantville suburbanite 9-to-5 grind type of life. And to just have something, even if it would be hard or miserable at first, seems adventurous by comparison.
Yeah, you know? I've always been somebody who could sort of pivot into a different life experience and go with it. Whether that's a, you know, a week-long camping trip or every time I go on vacation, I realize at the end of like 5 or 6 days, like, well, that's just my life now.
Sure.
I could just stick with it. So, yeah, I'm always ready for sort of a big change.
There's something that's appealing about this to me as well, in the sense that I would give up a lot to not have to work a traditional job. You know what I mean? I would love to sacrifice on the home that I live in, or the media that I have access to, or creature comforts, to just live my life and focus on the things that I want to do. Now, if I'm on a desert island, I don't really have a recording studio, so I can't focus on that part of myself, but it's still at least much more free of a lifestyle than, you know, what I live now.
I think you're preaching to the choir, you know, myself included, probably your audience here as well.
Yeah, probably. It's hating your job, hating a 9-to-5 job, or just the constraints of that is as American as apple pie, I'm sure. But
yeah, I think you're right. You know, I consider myself pretty lucky and try to make the most and enjoy my profession as well. But I definitely don't consider it the primary focus of my life. And I don't think anyone in our, you know, socioeconomic bubble can probably feel the same way.
Sure. Well, this might be a pretty good transition into your album itself. I think Swiss Family Robinson is probably decidedly more appealing than, say, Robinson Crusoe, because at least you have people to talk to. You've got your loved ones there. Sometimes if you're stranded with people you love, like for anybody who's ever been on a family vacation, maybe it's not ideal, but I think long term, it's way more appealing to have that companionship than to just be on your own and completely isolated. But I think you mentioned to me that that's one of the things that one of the themes that you tease out of the album you're going to talk about in a second. So maybe we just
You can kind of picture this album as like my Wilson. you know, it's the volleyball that I found on the island, and yeah, I project a lot onto it. And I think it's kind of a, it's both a deep and also thin album, sort of in terms of subject matter. But well, you want me to introduce it?
Yeah, let's get into it.
So I'm a big Neil Young fan, but I picked sort of a less critically acclaimed album of his that's one of my favorites. It's On the Beach. All right, so you know it's on the beach, so it's kitschy and it's with the theme in that way. But it's also a really reflective album, and it comes at a time in Neil Young's career where he was sort of he had distanced himself from Crosby, Still, Nash, Young. He had, you know, sort of sought isolation on purpose and started playing with a bunch of session musicians. In a really, actually, what I'd consider to be kind of a more modern, you know, music production context. At the time, you know, he was so into hardware and stuff that he brought a whole kit of stuff with him. But you could imagine like a hotel room session with a bunch of people that didn't know each other before the day, but who had all decided like, sure, yeah, we'll play with Neil Young and throw some things together. So it's not like a really, mastered album in the audio world, like it's not, it's rough and edgy. And I think a lot of people have been making more and more music that way, since then. And of course it's coming from Neil Young, who's sort of been an advocate for really high, compression formats of music and sort of advocates for, for music that's really full spectrum radio or audio production quality kind of stuff, or that there's things that you don't hear if you don't have the, you know, the FLAC file or the, you know, the special player that doesn't just play MP3s. And that was sort of an interesting time too. But
so it's a decidedly lo-fi album almost.
That's it.
For somebody.
Yeah, that's it.
That's interesting. And I full disclosure, do not know, have not had that much exposure to Neil Young. In fact, you're probably the only person who's ever really exposed me to him. I did a little bit of listening just in advance of the episode to get a sense of what this album is like, a little bit of research about him and the album in general. And one of the things that stood out to me as I was reading is that this was, like you said, less critically acclaimed than some of his other things, and kind of coming off the back of an album that was a lot more successful commercially and critically, and also just more depressing. There was like a lot of quotes from music critics saying they found it to be one of the more depressing albums of the era, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, you definitely get it. You definitely get that through a lot of the even overt subject matter of the song. So he's like talking very literally about critical acclaim or about critique, or about public opinion, or you know, music journalism at the time was like, it was a new frontier. But you've got, you know, Almost Famous. They're talking in a, you know, a film that our generation would have seen about, you know, the music journalist as the enemy, you know. Yeah. Because it's a juxtaposition against the craft, and it is a critique, and it places things on an arbitrary scale, and this and that and the other thing. But should your audience, you know, be able to, you know, discuss your work in a flushed out kind of way? Like, yeah, I think people need to write things down to have a discussion or get into a subject matter, and that shows appreciation too. So, but yeah, he's totally coping with it in this album.
And he seems like he's got a little bit of a fuck you attitude in general. One of the quotes that I read by him, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I liked this a lot, where he said, "I make things to make things. I don't make things to sell things. That's what other people do."
Yeah, that's right.
And there's something cool about that he doesn't care if people didn't like this album, because that's what was flowing out of him at the time. The other interesting thing that I read about this is that he recorded one of his other albums before this one, but this was released prior to that. So
it was kind of easier to get out the door.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, you're right. And so, you know, distancing himself from the group he was playing with before, he references on this album, a previous band manager telling the group that they're all pissing in the wind, you know, sort of because they were arguing and they had different opinions about the what the music should or could be. I think Neil Young always wanted to do something more serious or more important, and he definitely talks about, you know, following the muse, which was like the, you know, the it's a, you know, it's both music and it's, you know, sort of maybe otherworldly inspiration, yeah, you know. But I think he really did sort of, you know, probably lose money by walking away from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Did he, you know, but he had enough notoriety. And I think this album, he really, he kind of earned the freedom to do whatever he wanted. It's sort of modern in that sense, because a lot of musicians today can sort of maybe start at the place where On the Beach is kind of recorded. Yeah. Like find a couple people to play with and put an album together. It's accessible to anyone. But he kind of talks a lot about just living on his ranch in Canada and kind of, you know, there's a great video of him on YouTube where he's listening. He's sitting on the field. There's like bales of hay behind him. He's listening to a recording, and he's like, roadies are putting speakers up into the fields behind him of the song Words. And they ask him like, are you happy with this? It was like a journalist. Are you happy with this recording yet? Like, no, I'm not happy with this yet, but it's getting close. But what he was really happy with, and you could tell in the video, is like being on his ranch and playing music really loud. So I got a kick out of that, just thinking like, yeah, that was his freedom. And he definitely had to cope with his own like material wealth, because people knew that he had, you know, commercial success. And you know, here he was though with this kind of simple ideal of like just taking it all back up to his ranch and kind of hanging out.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that it's a retreat for him. To just kind of say, I need to recenter and figure out what it is to be on my own and what it, I don't want to say to do, create something more pure necessarily.
Yeah.
But
well, one thing that I think Neil really knew how to do, probably still knows how to do, is create the situation, the scenario, the time and place where inspiration will come and where, you know, good material, good content, like will be produced by virtue of you just paying the right attention to the right things at the right time, making the time and place for yourself to be, you know, reflective or creative.
To receive, or keep the antennas clear.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's really it. So I definitely feel that way in my own life, and try to come up with like, maybe it's just like a day out of my work week where, you know, that evening I'm going to dedicate to something. You kind of have to show up. I think On the Beach is definitely an album where the approach was, show up and try to make something good.
Is there are there any songs in particular that you think highlight that element of retreating or starting fresh, maybe?
Well,
or...
okay, so it's super overt right off the bat. You've got Walk On, and it's you know, it's not a metaphor. It's literally like, you know, here I am leaving the scene behind and starting to do something else over here. Yeah.
One of the more up-tempo songs on the record, too.
It's a toe-tap.
I recall from listening. Yeah.
So, okay, so here I am on my desert island. You know, what am I doing right now? I'm chopping down trees. I'm raking some sand. I don't know what you do. Fighting off a tiger.
I think there's something to having an album where there's a spectrum of emotions on there for that desert island experience, because you don't necessarily want something that's constantly happy and upbeat, even though that might be somebody's instinct, that you want something that's going to keep your spirits up, because at a certain point that's just going to make you angry that this album is constantly happy and you're miserable. You can't eat, you're going to eat your 10,000th coconut.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, Neil wanted the B side of this album to be the A side and vice versa. And he regretted the decision of the B side becoming the B side, and it has the three more somber reflective songs on it. You know, it was totally a producer's choice to put this kind of context-setting song at the beginning of the album. And it paves the way for a couple kind of more, like, you know, not angry, but, like, I guess angry kind of songs.
Yeah.
Like Vampire Blues, you know, just like a direct dig at the oil industry, kind of, you know, being an environmentalist and trying to advocate for something.
Let's put a little bit of that, too. Well, it's interesting too, because if you're talking about it in terms of like stages of grief almost, because I think there probably was some element of that for him. To anytime you leave any project, maybe in this case it's Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you're going to have that kind of grief period. And it makes more sense if you're seeing the anger and the depression parts, and then you switch to side B and there's Walk On and it's the acceptance. Whereas to start with that out the gate is, it feels like more like now you're descending.
It's heavy. Yeah.
You're descending into the heavy stuff.
Yeah. I think you can also listen to this song, and I think probably, you know, people do. There's probably some oil magnate out there who listens to this song and is like, yeah, I am a vampire. I take what I can get. And there's something self-empowering about it from that angle. So I know that, even Neil himself would probably be like, you know, people are talking on a podcast about me right now. Like that's not about me.
Bullshit.
That's about them.
Yeah.
It's bullshit. Yeah. You know, there was a whole thing about his music being used in presidential campaigning for, I don't know, we won't even say.
I can't imagine that being cool with him for.
Yeah,
no, who it was.
I think you could totally listen to this and not get it. But
yeah, vampires are really in right now.
They're in, yeah. You know, there's the guys with like the giant flags in their pickup beds and the smokestacks on the top, you know, who can really celebrate that like fossil fuels are something that they're using and abusing. But that's not the idea, obviously, in the song here.
So what's obviously this is pretty heavy just in terms of social critique, but other songs that are exploring like that, the darker, maybe the valley of a hard reset, a hard career reset.
Other songs from the album itself or from a different album or something
from
else?
This, I guess from this album for the time being, I think a couple of the ones you mentioned in advance were See the Sky About to Rain or Motion Pictures.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could talk about See the Sky About to Rain. It's a revisitation of a song that was arranged and recorded previously. But why it made sense to do it this way and to do it on this album, it feels to me like a projection of a lived experience in a peaceful, more natural place than like the beaches of LA or you know, Venice Beach or wherever. Like LA in general, it's kind of like the retreat to something in the past.
Yeah, got it. It's LA to Seattle, maybe.
Yeah,
something
sure.
Something like that.
Yeah.
How much of a departure is it from the original recording?
Well, so what you got here is like, you know, a session musician on the day, we could look up his name from the album liner notes, playing the Fender Rhodes. You know, there's the lap steel. It's probably all pretty consistent, but you get the kind of raw, unleveled, studio recording that the artist himself hit the button on. And I don't think you necessarily get that in a previous recording.
So maybe this is like the director's cut of the song, if you will.
Yeah, and I think the lap steel in the song is really what does it for me. It's such a compliment to his vocal melodies. It almost has like a pure on tone kind of aesthetic to it, where he can kind of be like a little bit, you know, flat or sharp or whatever. It sort of plays into the character of the lyrics,
sure.
but when the lap steel is like right on the note, and you kind of, your brain is just kind of tickled by how singular it is. My uncle who fishes a lot, wanted to take me fishing one day, and he said, you know, you want to go out today? And I was kind of wondering about the weather. And he told me, it will rain. He didn't mean like today. He meant kind of like when you like going fishing, you go fishing whether it's raining or not. And you kind of know like, well, as soon as you go with a plan in your head, it's gonna rain.
Yeah.
I kind of like that this song's like, you know, there's rain coming. You can be one way or the other about it. Sometimes I just like to walk in the rain and relax all the muscles that were tensed up and kind of think like, well, how would I be walking if it wasn't raining at all, or if I was like having the best day of my life and try doing that, even
sure.
though it's coming down?
There's a Make Lemonade vibe to it that would be right at home in a desert island setting.
Or maybe you're up on Neil's ranch and you're seeing the sky about to rain, but you're sitting on your porch. You know, you're gonna be sitting dry on the porch and having a nice night either way. So you might as well just sit back and watch it.
Maybe we'll do one. We'll just do one more off of this, and then. I'll hit you with some kind of rapid fire questions.
That sounds great.
So talk to me about motion pictures.
Sure. Well, what are they, you know, when they write about the song, they talk about his relationship at the time with an actress in some films. I like the song. You know, I don't think you have to appreciate an artistic rendering for its perspective. Obviously, like, any audience is going to receive a work and sort of interpret it upon themselves. So I used to work on motion pictures. I kind of left the whole world of that behind and moved into another career. But so I kind of, you know, selfishly think back, like, yeah, okay, maybe it's about me reflecting in my life about something, I don't know.
Yeah.
Entertainment being.
Well, there are touch points in the song that you can see yourself in, so that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think what I really love about this song are the calls to thinking about nature. I hear the mountains are doing fine. You know, I don't necessarily have to be there to think about them and know they're doing well and know that I would be appreciating them if I was there. So, you know, sometimes you find yourself in a fluorescent lit room staring at a computer screen and I'll put this song on to think, like, maybe I'm somewhere else, or maybe somewhere else is happening right now and I just have to sort of tap into it.
Well, let me ask you just a handful of questions. So these are, we covered what album you'd take with you, if it's just one single album. I'm curious if the answer would be different if the question is one single song you could have with you on a desert island.
That's a tough one. Oh, man. And on the spot, too.
I know.
Well, I'll tell you, I get a lot out of one artist in particular, more contemporary or you know, playing shows around now, Dan Deacon, kind of a magician, you know, kind of a black box, builds a lot into any given track. So I think about, like, any given, or maybe I'll give you one specific, like When I Was Done Dying, Dan Deacon. You could listen to that 100 times and find different things to focus on because it's just so layered and so dense. And it all contributes to the same really effective rendering of intent, which is, like, totally introspective, high-level perspective about life and dying and death and the afterlife and all this stuff packed into, like, one little just, like, so meaty kernel of a song. I'd say that. Yeah, I'd give you Dan Deacon, When I Was Done Dying. I think when it came out, I was just, like, I was blown away. I mean, I was receptive. I was ready to – I needed him to come out with something that would rival everything I had already appreciated. But When I Was Done Dying was a great, great track off that album.
Well, I mean, talk about re-listen value. When it's something that's that layered and complex, of course, it's great for just coming back to it over and over again and saying, what have I not seen before or heard before?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say you can take an artist's entire discography with you. Does that change?
Wow. It's an entirely different question. It's like taking a friend with you.
Totally.
You kind of got to pick somebody with a good personality.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of discographies I'd like to hang out with for a long time. I settle back on some, like, simpler stuff. Like, I get a kick out of even, like, Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead, just because I kind of get that, you know, time's sort of this ending continuum that you only experience right now, and you can be kind of rough around the edges and kind of you can have a discography but, like, a million variations within that discography. So maybe that's a cop out, but, like, I don't know, if you'd gathered all of the in concert recordings taken by bootleggers of, like, every Grateful Dead show, you'd have, like, 18 versions of
with.
18 versions of every song that you liked, and you'd get to maybe compare and contrast the different. Maybe that's what I'd do, is I just say, like, all right, give me everything from the Grateful Dead forever, and I can kind of occupy myself.
You become the world's foremost Grateful Dead scholar. Basically.
It's so technical. Yeah, you'd have to. You'd have to be, like, talking about the difference between a flat and a sharp and this song at this moment in time.
There's something almost Malcolm Gladwellian about what you could do given that Desert Island scenario with an entire band's discography and just be like, I have an encyclopedic knowledge of this. Nobody knows this or has absorbed this or appreciates it on a level that I I can appreciate it on.
There's that, and there's also the, like, if you're gonna set up a tiki bar, you know, what's gonna play there? Like, contextually, yeah. You're not gonna pick something that, like, you know, someone wouldn't listen to while sipping painkillers.
I was thinking about this question in particular, and for me, I think it would be the Beatles, which sounds extremely cliche, except kind of the reasoning for that for me is that I can't claim to be a massive Beatles fan in the sense that I really only know the songs that they're most famous for, really the only album that I've spent time start to finish appreciating was Sgt. Pepper. And outside of that, again, I know
well,
the
you
hits.
Don't have to
They've got an
the
extensive catalog of hits, but
if you've only scratched the surface of a really deep catalog, I think that's like the same kind of cop-out answer I was given, that like maybe there's like, you know, you're going to load up, you're on a long plane flight, you're going to load up as many movies as you can, right? You kind of have to find the area where you can get a lot out of what already exists. So you've got a lot to dig, and if you found out, that's like reading the first couple novels off a shelf of somebody who's got, like, you know, a whole section of your library. You just get started.
And it's, I mean, it's that thing where you're like, I know it would be great because they've got such a reputation, and I know enough of their music to know I'd enjoy it. But then there's also it's like a book that you've always said you're going to read, but you just can't seem to make time for it. That's how Beatles appreciation is for me. And the I think just if there was any other artist that you're just going to take a leap of faith and say, that's the catalog I'm going to take with me, there's the risk that it would be terrible. But I feel like 99% confident I wouldn't take the Beatles with me, start listening, and then regret it and wish that I picked
you'd never
Blues Traveler or something.
Yeah, no, never. Never in a million years.
So let's see. I think I've got another one. Yeah. All right. I guess just maybe some honorable mentions.
Yeah.
For albums, I guess.
Ooh, for albums themselves. I mean, so I'm back spinning on the like artist full discography collection, but I'm thinking about David Bowie and which album to bring with me. You know, Ziggy Stardust is a classic, and I think I could probably hit that on repeat a lot too. So the question again was.
This question?
Yeah.
Honorable mentions.
Oh, honorable.
For albums.
Okay, so like backup album. Yeah, okay. So yeah, I'll stick with that. I'll stick with Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Okay. Like that. Well, do you feel like you've fully articulated what makes On the Beach such a great Desert Island album? Are you ready to?
I think it would be doing it a disservice to go any deeper.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot to it just right on the surface. It's pretty accessible.
Fair enough. Well, then in that case, why don't we'll transition over to our drinking game. This I'm going to call this one Island in the Sun. And the way it's going to work, you're going to have a 50-50 shot on all these questions. If you get it right, I have to drink. If you get it wrong, you have to drink. Really straightforward. If you get 4 out of 7 correct, you win our prize for today. That is a copy of Drinking Buddies, the Drinking Man's Thinking Game.
Wow. Okay, great.
So question number one. Which of the following classic Castaway stories is believed to be inspired by true events? Is it A, Robinson Crusoe, or B, Swiss Family Robinson?
Ooh, I think it's actually Swiss Family Robinson. I could be wrong. I, you know,
final answer. I mean, it's your 50-50.
I'm gonna stick with it. Yep.
It's actually Robinson Crusoe.
Okay. All right. All right. I believe that.
I'll
take your word for it.
All right. So take a drink.
Yep.
You've got 6 more to stay alive. So, number 2, the question of whether men prefer Marianne or Ginger has endured long after Gilligan's Island's cancellation. If the debate were to be settled based on the number of fan letters sent to the actresses who portrayed them, which of the two characters would win?
Wow. I mean, not that receiving letters from fans. Well, I don't know where I'm going with that. Who would have
I'm
received
more letters?
I'm not
saying it's a great measure. I'm saying if that were the measure.
Okay. If that were the measure, I'm going to say this is like the, it's the answer you didn't think was the answer question. So it's got to be Ginger.
This is more of a go with your gut one.
Wow.
It is Marianne.
Wow. Okay.
This surprised me. Marianne, the actress who played Marianne, and forgive me, I don't have her these actresses' names in front of me. She received roughly 5,000 fan letters a week. A week. That's insane. To Ginger's 2,000 a week.
Wow.
All right. Hopefully this, I'm going to get into softball territory a bit more now. Does Tom Hanks' character in the movie Castaway work for FedEx or UPS?
Oh, shoot. I'm going to say FedEx, but I honestly don't remember.
You're right.
Yeah.
I will take a drink.
Nice. Yeah, that was like a scent memory. I just had to trust it.
It'd be lame if it was UPS.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not as cool sounding as FedEx. Okay. Number four, Portuguese castaway Fernão Lopes spent 30 years on the uninhabited island of St. Helena. Which of the following animals did he take as a pet during his time on the island? Is it A, a rooster, or B, a pig?
Hmm. Well, man, that's a great... I don't know the answer. I'm going to have to reason my way to it. If a rooster was your companion, you'd have like one reason a day to like think about getting rid of him. But a pig's sort of a tastier companion to have to debate whether you were, you had to make another plan for him. I think like the one that's more of a dilemma is the pig. So if he chose the pig, you know, that shows like true companionship. And I think pigs have a lot going on too in their brain. Like you might have a pig that's almost as much of a companion as a dog. A rooster, you'd have to be pretty compromising to really make a good companion out of, I think.
So you're going with
pig? I'm going with the pig, yeah.
It is the rooster.
Wow.
Actually.
Wow, okay.
He must be one of those people that prefers to have friends that are dumber than him. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I was sitting here choosing. He probably didn't get to choose either.
It also could be availability. I don't
know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's a really good point. His story is disturbing. I did like a bunch of research on real life castaways, and he was like a Portuguese soldier ended up siding with local Muslims in India where he was stationed, and so became was pronounced a traitor. His people lopped off one of his arms and his ears and nose and exiled him to this island.
And he still found the rooster.
He still found a rooster and survived for over 30 years.
I was going to say, there's probably no way that you don't find the rooster.
I don't know how you don't eat it at that point. I mean, because if you're one-handed, your meals are probably not coming by you so easily. So anyway, hats off to him. But there are a ton of disturbing stories about what people do when they're trapped on.
Yeah, I hope in my desert island story, it's not actually exile. Like I kind of hope it would be like a choice, or at least like a, like maybe I was flying somewhere nice and it was like a bad pit stop.
All right. So you got one at this point. I think you've missed. You got to get the rest of them right.
All right. I'll give it a whirl.
Number five. When Odysseus is shipwrecked and washes ashore on the island of Ogygia in Homer's Odyssey, the nymph Calypso compels him to remain as her lover for 7 years. What does Calypso's name mean in English? Is it A, to restrain or subdue, or B, to conceal or to hide?
Oh, it's got to be conceal and hide, because that's just, I mean, one would have been you wrote the name for the character as you put the story together. The other would be it that the character had a name that meant something before the context. I might be making the wrong choice again, too.
You're right. That is the right answer, although I think classical literature is filled with instances of characters whose names are written based on the story.
Yeah, but Homer had more going on.
I suppose that's true. I'm in too much of a biblical mindset where it's like, this character's name is straight up what his function is.
Yeah, you know, like the Cyclops existed before there was a reason to have a plot twist.
That's a good point. All right, so you've got two right so far. You've got two more to go. Number six, on the TV show Lost, the character Hurley worked at which fast food restaurant prior to being stranded on the island? Is it A, Mr. Cluck's Chicken Shop, or B, Marty's Clam Shack?
So I'll be honest, I never watched the show. I probably would enjoy it, but I was watching everybody watch it. Like, I felt like they were getting jerked around. They were all expecting something they weren't going to get.
I've seen like a 2 episodes of the show tops. It's not to say this is a hint, but which of those two names sounds more contrived to you?
Yeah, I think it's got to be Klux, and I think as a New Englander, like the Clam Shack is maybe the thing that like my mind went with initially, because of course like that's the more marketable concept, but. It would be a
better name. I mean, it's the marketer in me that was like, you need to punch that up a little bit. It's Marty's Clam Shack. And totally change your product.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah, but you're right. So I'll take a drink. You've got one last question. This is for, again, our prize today of Drinking Buddies, the strategic card-based drinking game for 4 to 8 players. Number 7. The boys in William Golding's The Lord of the Flies are left stranded on an island after A, plane crash, or B, a shipwreck.
I should know this. It's been a long time since I read this book.
Same.
It's got to be a shipwreck because it's just too old.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not sure. I don't know. You're telling me I gave you the wrong answer. I'm not telling you
anything. I'm just asking you to be really deliberate and really consider your answer here.
So the way to find the answer to this question is to know whether this book was written, I guess, like before World War One.
It is written after World War One.
Yeah, so it could easily be either one.
It was written actually after World War II. In the 50s, I believe.
So, like, public opinion's almost more trustworthy of ship travel.
Well, so here's what I would say. Here's my reasoning. We've had a lot of questions today that are shipwreck focused.
Yep.
Also, shipwreck would be the most obvious choice in this case. So there are those questions where a quiz show host might be directing you, or might be trying to misdirect. So. I don't know if that does anything for you, but are you going to hang in there with
no,
with
I'm going to change my answer. I'm going to change my answer because I think I'm receiving a lot of hints that I chose the wrong one.
You basically asked the audience.
I burned both my lifelines, I'm pretty sure. but yeah, so it had to be a plane crash, and imagine that, like all those kids getting a ride on a plane.
You're right. You've got 4 out of 7 correct.
Hot dog.
So that's like, I mean, what a comeback. I gotta say too, I was really, I really appreciate how much of a nail biter that was, because I think this is the first episode where anybody's even come close to losing.
Wow.
So I was starting to really feel like these questions were way too easy, and you've just made me feel like,
well, I'll tell
I'm
you what,
right
I,
on track.
What I didn't do is I knew the theme and I didn't go home and do a lot of homework ahead of time. I sort of showed up with whatever I had in my head.
I sort of bank on guests not doing that, though, and just getting by on blind luck. So you did it correct. I think I may have just like turned up the difficulty level to hard a little bit on this one. But and it's always a crapshoot, too, when it's 50-50 per question.
Yep.
Like you just could have a bad day, but anyway, it doesn't matter because you won, so you'll win the prize. I'll get that to you right after this. I'm just going to briefly plug some of my shit. This podcast is brought to you by Wasted Minds. You can check out our website at wasted-minds.com. We've got another great podcast that I love stars my better half and the infamous Chinmo. It's Conquest, a podcast where your hosts talk about conventions, fandom, and all things pop culture. You can check them out at Conquest Pod on Twitter. Again, you can also check them out on our website. We've got a link over to their podcast site. And then we mentioned Drinking Buddies. You can sign up for our Drinking Buddies mailing list at wasted-minds.com/Kickstarter. We'll be kicking off our Kickstarter campaign in the spring, so sign up there. We'll keep you in the loop on all the latest updates on the project and let you know as soon as the campaign has gone live. Mike, is there anything you'd like to plug for yourself?
Oh, you know, I'm not really like a self-promoter by nature, but
thanks,
I got a couple things
that
I put out
finger.
There. No, I mean, I, you know, if I had something more to promote, maybe I would. I got some tracks up that you can listen to on SoundCloud under the name Alpaca Tax Breaks. So if you go to soundcloud.com/alpacataxbreaks, you can listen to some of the music I'm putting together in my free time. I don't know. Follow me on Instagram. That's where I put all my effort. It's Run From Robots. I do a lot of drone photography, videography. Awesome. Sometimes I put my music to my drone shots and sort of put, like, if I'm putting something creative together, it'll probably show up there. So, yeah, that's where I'd go to check it out.
Awesome. I have enjoyed being more exposed to Neil Young as a result of this. It's daunting how much music there is out there, and to have recommendations from people whose perspective and tastes I respect is something that is really enriching me as a result of this podcast. So thanks for being a part of that. To everybody listening at home, here's to you.